There was a time, not really all that long ago, when some wondered if Australia's relationship with China might serve as a model for how developed democracies could deal amicably and constructively with a developing autocracy. That time appears to be conclusively over. Relations between Beijing and Canberra, deteriorating a while, have cratered spectacularly in recent months. Australia has excluded Huawei from Australia's 5G network. Australia has called for an international investigation into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's spoken up in support of Hong Kong and protested against China's treatment of its Uyghur minority. And China has bristled at all of these moves. Some of China's responses have been merely rhetorical and cosmetic, including crudely goading Australia over alleged crimes committed by Australian troops in Afghanistan. Others have had more measurable effects, devastating tariffs on Australian exports to China, including especially ruinous levies on Australian wine. Has China decided to fall out with Australia? How should Australia, or any other country China has a pop at, react or adjust? And is there any way back to cooperation with China for Australia or anyone else? This is the Foreign Desk.
My advice to Prime Minister Morrison repeatedly has been, do more, say less. Do more is, in fact, a series of concrete measures enhancing our national security powers, enhancing our fundamental economic power, enhancing our population growth, and strengthening our alliances and relationships with countries around the world, not just the United States, but in Southeast Asia and beyond as well.
So this kind of patriotism and chest puffing plays very well as China's coming out of COVID. Domestically, they want to show and deflect residual public anger over its botched cover-up and handling. And so getting the country to unite in this way to show that they can stand up and push back against the West, I mean, that's a really good message to be sending. So it's really two birds, one stone.
The Chinese government should be totally ashamed of this post. It diminishes them in the world's eyes.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. China is not a nation known for its impulsivity where foreign policy is concerned. Beijing tends to act carefully and deliberately, so it should be assumed that it is acting carefully and deliberately towards Australia. For a look at what China is doing and why China is doing it, I'm joined first of all from Beijing by Sophia Yan, China correspondent for The Daily Telegraph. Sophia, first of all, I think what we're trying to establish here is whether this is a specific row between China and Australia or something we might see more of in China's dealings with Western democracies in general. But we will start with Australia. Does it strike you that China is going out of its way to pick a fight with Australia, or is this something that's just kind of happened organically?
Absolutely. China's definitely targeting Australia. It's been going for some time, and it's obviously hit a peak now. It's every day there seems to be something new in this broader diplomatic spat between Beijing and Canberra. And what Beijing's really trying to do is to make Australia a cautionary tale. Australia is a major US ally, part of the Five Eyes Alliance, and Australia matches on values with America. So punishing Australia is a way for China to send a message to other US allies or other countries just thinking about siding with Washington and to try to prevent them from considering policies that China dislikes, bans on Chinese tech firms over national security risks, the Huawei issue, for instance, even territorial disputes in the South China Sea, being public about stances over Hong Kong and Taiwan. I mean, China does not want countries to get involved with what it thinks is its own backyard. So pressuring Australia this way is just one way to show, hey, this is what could happen to your country if you dare to take us on. There's an upside to this too. It's a certain swagger for the domestic audience to show that this all-powerful country, China, can finally stand up to the West. You have to remember that for the Chinese government and for many Chinese people, there's a very painful history and memory of what's called the, quote, century of humiliation. That was the 100 years before the Communist Party took power in 1949, during which many say the glorious Chinese empire crumbled at the hands of foreign powers, the Brits, the Russians, the Japanese. China at the time lost almost all the wars it fought. And actually, that's when, for instance, Hong Kong was ceded to the Brits. So this kind of patriotism and chest puffing plays very well as China's coming out of COVID. Domestically, they want to show and deflect residual public anger over its botched cover-up and handling. And so getting the country to unite in this way to show that they can stand up and push back against the West. I mean, that's a really good message to be sending. So it's really two birds, one stone.
There's a number of things going on there, but let's just focus on one of them because it is a proximate cause of China's irritation with Australia and indeed China's irritation with a few other countries, which is Huawei and other Chinese companies being locked out of 5G networks. Why does China perceive that as an argument worth starting? Because it's not imaginable that any of these countries are going to change their minds.
Huawei is, in a way, a national champion. It's a private company. It's not state-owned. But, of course, any company that succeeds in China is in some way state-approved, shall we say. So to succeed here, you definitely need to have certain party officials. You need to have something called guanxi, these relationships, and people in high positions in your corner. And so Huawei is a company that really shows and reflects the rise of China. It's headquartered in Shenzhen, which just 2-3 decades ago was a rice paddy backwater. Now it's the Silicon Valley hub of China. And this company itself really does show how quickly the economy here has grown. China now the world's second largest economy. And so China, from a very broad level, wants to be taken seriously on the world stage. And so attacking Huawei, a company that many would consider really a national champion, is attacking the status that China now thinks it should have on the world stage. So it's ironic also that there's concern from Beijing that other nations are talking about Huawei as a national security risk, because China itself has long said that it wants to keep certain key industries, telecoms, utilities, oil and gas, within its own country as state-owned enterprises, because they themselves, Beijing, is concerned about the very same issue, that foreign players could come into the country, take a big share of the market, and therefore be competitive domestically. They didn't want to see control here to foreign companies over this issue of national security. So it's actually a bit ironic, I would say, for China to now be upset with other nations for saying that a Chinese company coming in to build critical national infrastructure, whether that's a nuclear plant or the telecoms network, for them to say, hey, you can't say that this is a risk. We don't pose a risk. It's not very fair, really, for China to be saying that to other nations.
In China's dealing with Australia, as well as the kind of lofty, wounded rhetoric we're talking about, we've also seen a fair amount of, I guess, what you might think of as Russia-style diplomacy by trolling, sort of posting those mocked-up images and cartoons of Australian troops committing crimes in Afghanistan, seeing the Global Times floating the idea that COVID-19 was in fact imported from Australia and was not of Chinese origin at all. Is there no part of the Chinese Communist Party that considers that sort of thing a bit beneath it?
It's come in the last couple of years, this sort of rise in this sort of rhetoric and the willingness to push disinformation. It's amplified on Twitter. There are bots that will retweet a lot of these incorrect, inaccurate tweets. Now, seeding greater disinformation in the public works in China's favor. It gives it some sort of plausible deniability. There are other threads that can take a life of its own. And if there are other threads or potential theories, that's all Beijing needs. They don't need to necessarily hold much water. As long as they exist, it gives Beijing a chance to say, well, what about this other idea? What about this other possibility? And that's what they really want. They want to cloud what people are thinking and what they know, just to kind of muddy the waters a bit. And again, this goes back to what I was saying about swagger for domestic audience, being able to show that they can stand up against the West, being able to show that, hey, it's not just us, that it could be this idea that the West is again attacking us and that we need to stand up for ourselves. And so doing that really is aimed at trying to speak with a powerful voice and to try to be taken more seriously.
If we go back to the idea that China is using Australia as a cautionary example to the rest of the world, how calculated is their employment of Australia in that role? Is it the fact that while Australia is a prominent country which has a presence on the world stage, it's also actually quite a small country in terms of population? There are 25 million people in Australia. China has some cities bigger than that.
Well, Australia was really far ahead in the Western world in terms of recognizing the challenges of undue Chinese influence on its soil. In many ways, it led the way for greater public recognition of why more exposure to China and Chinese companies could be potentially an issue. They also banned Huawei very early on, and they're in the neighborhood of the South China Sea, so they've gotten involved and been very forward thinking about these territorial disputes. They also called for an international inquiry with COVID. Of course, other nations piled onto that, but Australia led that. And so China is calculated in this, in the sense that they are going after US allies. They have picked fights also with Canada, for instance, with many other nations, but they're really going after Australia to prove a point, to show that A, they can do this, B, it's going to hurt, and C, if other nations are thinking about it, you better stop thinking that you should go up against Beijing because it's, you're not going to win. I mean, it's really this sort of hooplinks first mentality, and they're going to keep going, really, because again, this is about showing the world that they won't back down.
But is part of the point in going after Australia that it will hurt Australia, as you correctly point out, but it probably won't hurt China all that much?
That is definitely something that China wants the world to be thinking about. A lot of nations are in a similar position to Australia. As we've seen with supply chains during this year with the coronavirus pandemic, many countries are very much trade dependent on China. And so that's a business and economic relationship that it's easy for Beijing to leverage that in its favor. We've seen it before. China has in the past called for boycotts of South Korean and Japanese products because of other diplomatic spats at that time. And it does work. Entire South Korean conglomerates have had to pull out of China before because of these boycotts, because they were pressured so much, and sometimes because of surprise regulatory issues that are thrown up domestically for these companies when they're in China. It's very convenient, sort of like these inquiries into Australian goods that are coming into China. It's very convenient for them to happen, and it's hidden behind a lot of bureaucracy and lots of paperwork. And what that's doing really is to show that whether or not Australia is able to handle it, there's also a question of whether or not its allies, like the US, will stand up on behalf of Australia. And if they aren't going to take a stronger tack, then China has again proved yet another point, which is that perhaps that alliance network is not as strong as it seems to be. And so this divide and conquer strategy in the long term really weakens the Western world.
Well, on that thought, how much of this, China picking on Australia in particular, does contain an element of posturing in advance of the arrival of a new administration in Washington?
Before that happens, before Biden comes into the White House, China's goal is likely to be to show that it will maintain its position, that it's not going to get any softer. Of course, the US with the transition team for Biden, they're thinking the same thing. The messaging from the US so far after the election has been that the policy will be the same, that nothing's going to change. And so neither side will want to cede ground or to show that they might be willing to cede ground. So right now it's sort of a game of poker, really, trying to keep up appearances until that next administration's in and some sense of where policy direction might be. Before that becomes clearer, China, no way will Beijing want to show any sort of weakness, any sign of that.
Sophia Yan in Beijing, thank you for joining us. Australia's relationship with China is very arguably the greatest foreign policy challenge facing any Australian Prime Minister, as our next guest knows firsthand. Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister of Australia from 2007 to 2010, and again more briefly in 2013. He also served as an Australian diplomat in China in the 1980s and is now President of the Asia Society Policy Institute. He joins us from Queensland's Sunshine Coast. Kevin Rudd, thank you for joining us and welcome back to the Foreign Desk. Let's start with where we are now. If we think, at least on the scale of modern history, how bad are China-Australia relations right now?
Most of us who have been both analysts and participants in this relationship over the last several decades would say that in the near 50-year period since diplomatic relations were established in 1972, this is the worst stage that the relationship has reached. And that's against all measures, political, diplomatic, economic, security, human rights, you name it, it's all gone right down the tube. Many contributing factors to this, but in direct answer to your question, it's a 50-year low. I think the way to analyse what's unfolding in the Australia-China relationship is to see it in terms of the normal outworkings of a great power on the rise, in this case China, but abnormally, in this case, the rise of a power which is a one-party state with an authoritarian political system pursuing somewhat mercantilist economic policies, as well as seeking to adjust boundaries with its neighbours, both maritime and land-based boundaries. That is part of the reality, but it does impact not just Australia, but other American allies like Japan, the Republic of Korea, those in Southeast Asia, those in Central Asia, even the Russian Federation. But on the other hand, what you've had is an Australian government, as I said, somewhat incapable of differentiating between what I would describe as the operational characteristics of an effective China strategy, and confusing that, deliberately or otherwise, on a continuing basis, with a declaratory strategy which ends up being driven by domestic political imperatives. And so it is, in fact, the cocktail of these factors in imprecise correlation with each other, which actually produces the net result. And frankly, it's an ungodly mess. The time for circuit breaker has well and truly come, but at present, the mood for such a circuit breaker has not yet arrived.
But if you are not just necessarily this Australian government, but an Australian government, is there no grounds at all for concern about sinister designs China may have on Australia at this point? You know, in recent months and years, we've seen the detention of Australian journalists in China. There's been various influence peddling scandals in Australian politics. Michael Burgess, the Director General of ASIO, claims there's more espionage underway in Australia right now than there was during the Cold War.
Yeah, the key point here is what we conclude domestically in Australia as constituting real threats to Australian national security by given Chinese actions, whether it's in state-based espionage, cyber attacks, influence operations against Australian politicians or the media, or other such activities. In dealing effectively and robustly with each of those challenges, it is not necessarily mandated that you then take out a megaphone every second day and proclaim that from the rooftops. This is the constant differential I seek to explain between an operational strategy as opposed to a declaratory strategy. My advice to Prime Minister Morrison repeatedly has been, do more, say less. Do more is, in fact, a series of concrete measures enhancing our national security powers, enhancing our intelligence assets, enhancing our fundamental economic power, enhancing our population growth, and strengthening our alliances and relationships with countries around the world, not just the United States, but in Southeast Asia and beyond as well. And that is quite a separate matter from proclaiming, as I said, every second Tuesday morning, that there are Reds in the bed and there is about to be a landing at Bondi Beach by the Chinese amphibious force. It's quite a different matter. Intelligent and mature national strategy understands the difference between the two. And if you want to see a practical example of the difference between the two, look, for example, at how Japan, on a daily basis, weekly basis, in the last several years, handled its relationship with China. Relatively stable, notwithstanding the fact that Japan is A, an ally of the United States, B, is a liberal democracy, C, has China as its single largest economic partner, D, has American military bases on its soil, and E, has a rolling territorial dispute with China in the East China Sea over Senkaku Daiudai. Yet despite that, the Japan-China economic relationship proceeds relatively unmolested. Why? Because both Abe and Suga-san, who's replaced him, learned the eternal, shall we say, Eastern virtue of shutting up from time to time, as opposed to simply proclaiming everything from the rooftops. That's effective strategy, as opposed to opening your mouth all the time, which is primarily driven in Australia's case by a range of domestic political imperatives, which in turn complicate the foreign policy agenda you're seeking to prosecute.
At a national level, then, how does practically that relationship work? If you are, as you were, the Prime Minister of Australia and you wish to deal directly with China, who are you able to call? I mean, when you were PM, for example, would it have been possible to speak directly to Hu Jintao or Wen Jiabao, or is the relationship more layered than that?
In my period in office, I have spoken directly with Xi Jinping as president on the phone. A normal relationship would make that possible. When things got fairly willing in the period that I was in office in dealing with the Chinese on a range of issues, which by and large we chose not to put into the public domain, I dispatched special emissaries to Beijing to speak to them directly. There are ways and means in which these things are done other than through, you might be surprised to know, page one of the London Times, page three of the Sydney Daily Telegraph, or page five of the New York Times. I know journalists love things to be in print, but the business of diplomacy, last time I read, was not a rolling exercise in public journalism. It's somewhat more complex than that, and it needs to be because you're prosecuting a higher set of interests, namely the national interest. So therefore, there are ways in which you do this. We did not have perfect agreement with the Chinese at all when I was in office. We had multiple disagreements on foreign investment questions. I blocked their attempts to take over Rio Tinto. They were not happy. On human rights questions, when I say we, an Australian entity invited one of Xinjiang's leading human rights activists, Rabia Kadir, to Australia to receive an award. We declined to respond to Chinese pressure to deny her a visa. Chinese were not happy with that. They launched a cyber attack then on the Melbourne Film Festival, which hosted her. But you see, there are ways and means of dealing with each of these other than through, as I said, the daily repartee. International relations is somewhat different to the floor of the House of Commons, or in our case, the House of Representatives. What is useful in a domestic political debate is not always useful in producing the desired results in an international political debate.
I asked you about these things ages ago when you were Foreign Minister of Australia, and you made the point, as you said, that most people assume there's only two options for dealing with China. One of them is conflict and containment. The other, as you put it, is kowtow and compliance. But if you thought about China and you knew China, there's another way through this. You said that China's leaders are contemptuous of weakness and they respect consistency. Now, is that the nub of what we're looking at in terms of how this is being framed in Australian domestic politics now, that China does not take what is being said for domestic consumption in Australia seriously?
My argument to you back then is my argument today, and that there is always a third way in dealing with China, which is neither conflict nor kowtow. And part of that third way lies in being robust, consistent in your operational diplomacy, sparing in your declaratory diplomacy, and reinforced by a partnership in strength with your friends and allies around the world. That's what I mean by an effective strategy. And that's what I believe can be prosecuted in the case of China. China, in my own experience, is very mindful of what states do. It is less mindful of what states say. But on the question of what they say, if they directly attack the standing of the Chinese nation, the Chinese government, or the Chinese Communist Party, then a different set of imperatives enters into the equation driven by China's own domestic politics, which is to defend the integrity of their own nation state or their own political system. All I'm saying is that that level of complexity is by and large managed and or, if necessary, removed if you are more sparing in the use of your own declaratory declamations against the Chinese political system. What I'm seeking to explain here is that there is a clear difference between being absolutely clear-headed about the nature of the Chinese challenge and in some cases threat to one's own national security interests, economic interests, as well as our underpinning values. And on the other hand, being equally clear-minded about how those interests are best defended and advanced, whether it is through a series of operational measures undertaken with friends and allies or unilaterally, and where it is absolutely necessary to make a public declaration to that effect. That's the hallmark of a sophisticated strategy. As I said, if I was rendering this as a Japanese haiku, it would be along the following lines. Do more, speak less, or to put it into five syllables, do more and speak much less.
Is there a fundamental difficulty Australia keeps having, though, that it perhaps overestimates how much China needs it or cares about it? You'll have seen in recent weeks and months a certain amount of editorialising, especially from conservative voices in Australia, saying China will stop throwing its weight around. Eventually, they need Australia too much.
Oh, I think that's just wishful thinking on the part of those Australian conservative voices. Let's look at one critical area, which is Chinese coal imports from Australia, which my home state of Queensland has been important historically and prospectively, despite the fact that coal will eventually phase out as a consequence of climate change action around the world. But this is a significant Australian and Queensland commodity, but China is deliberately sourcing its needs either domestically or through other coal suppliers like Indonesia. The next cab off the rank would be iron ore. This is much more central to China's ongoing industrial requirements. But the alternative Chinese supply, of course, is Vale in Brazil. It'll take some time for China to expand its capabilities in Brazil, but China's long-term strategy would be to militate against any long-term dependency on Australia. Thirdly, on LNG, China currently is a significant market for LNG from this country, but is also increasingly reliant upon LNG supplies from Qatar in the Gulf. So therefore, it is utterly complacent on the part of Australian conservatives or business leaders to assume that, quote, China will come to its senses. A more robust approach to dealing with these questions is for A, Australia to diversify its own trade relationships rather than having, as it is now, nearly 40% of Australian exports dependent on the Chinese market. And B, when you find yourself in a scrap with Beijing, ideally never find yourself there on your own, but instead in partnership and solidarity with a group of other countries, principally the United States, Japan, Korea, the major Europeans and others, on a question of common principle and concern. That is the best way to deal robustly with our friends in Beijing, rather than this rolling exercise in domestic political self-indulgence, which is what we often see with the current Conservative government in Australia.
If we go back to where we came in then, and acknowledging that relations, as you put it, are at a 50-year low and you wouldn't start from here and so forth. But if the current government suddenly was mindful to take your advice on how to repair relations with China, is there a single constructive step they could take right now?
I think there are three steps, and they're in this sequence. One, the only way in which the Australia-China relationship will be restabilised, if it's restabilised within the framework of a parallel restabilisation of the US-China relationship. So much of what is occurring in the Canberra dynamic at the moment is occurring as a consequence of the overall negative trajectory of US-China relations. If the Biden administration, therefore, is going to restabilise relations with Beijing, a precondition for that on Biden's part must be the restabilisation of relations with its principal allies, not just Australia, but also countries like Canada, who've been going through the diplomatic chopping mill with China as well over the Meng-Huawei matter over a long period of time. Step two is that if that restabilization is agreed at the level of high diplomacy between Beijing and Washington, and there is an agreement to stabilize relations both with Ottawa and Canberra as well, then there has to be an agreement between Beijing and Canberra to then ensure that the outstanding disagreements between both governments are then dealt with through private diplomatic channels. And three, the corollary to two, is that both Beijing and Canberra agree to both bury their megaphones in the sand. That is the way in which we get a circuit breaker. If that doesn't occur, then the alternative for Canberra on, for example, the punitive tariffs being imposed for politically driven reasons against Australian exports to China is in fact taken to the World Trade Organization Disputes Tribunal, that other nations join cause with Australia in that action, as they did with Japan when China banned rare earth exports to Japan back in 2013, so that a common cause is had against China on the part of multiple countries and not just one. That, I think, is the fallback position. But in terms of the circuit breaker now, it'd be those three measures that I outlined before.
Kevin Rudd, thank you as always for joining us. And that is it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.